On this week's edition of New York Now, Thanksgiving could be a major trigger for the COVID-19 crisis in New York. We're watching the numbers.
You will see a tremendous spike after Thanksgiving.
Anna Gronewald from Politico joins me with analysis on that and the latest election results. Democrats hold on to their majority in the state Senate, giving them full control over state government. We'll speak with Senate Deputy Majority Leader Mike Gianaris about their plans for next year. A new coalition wants to fill the state's budget deficit by taxing stock transactions. Fred Kowal from United University Professions joins me to discuss. And with voters more divided than ever, we ask if there's an appetite for candidates who work across the aisle. Eric Olson from the Common Ground Committee joins us. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. More than 2,000 people are now hospitalized with COVID-19 in New York. We're now at levels that we haven't seen in more than 5 months. And it's likely to get worse in the next few weeks after people come together for Thanksgiving. Indoor gatherings of more than 10 people are now banned to reduce the spread of the virus. So that means big Thanksgiving dinners are technically not allowed this year in New York. That isn't stopping some people, and a handful of county sheriffs around the state say they're not going to enforce the rule. And that has Governor Cuomo even more worried about a post-Thanksgiving bump. Here he is this week.
I don't believe, as a law enforcement officer, you have a right to pick and choose what laws you will enforce. This living room spread is the new problem, and it will go up after Thanksgiving.
And Cuomo met this week with President-elect Joe Biden to talk about what states need from the federal government moving forward. Let's break it all down with Anna Gronewald from Politico New York. Anna, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
So the COVID numbers in New York, if you look at the curve that the state puts out every day, the graph, it's very clear that we have gone from a low to we are going up. And I think everybody's question, at least upstate, is I think we're all waiting for the shoe to drop in terms of, are we going to go back into a full lockdown? So talk to me about what the governor is doing right now and if he's given any indication on more severe restrictions that are coming.
Well, I think it's been fascinating because we see that curve going especially up in places in Western New York. I know we've already had some spikes in the Southern Tier. And so there, I think the governor is looking at it on a regional perspective and is still trying to go forward with his plan to target these microclusters, he calls them, that he puts them in different color-coded zones and says, well, we're going to take more specific restrictions here and others not so much quite here. But when we're looking at numbers go up across the state and some of the places even that were initially taken off more restrictions are now being put back on, I think everyone's just kind of feeling anxious that we're going to lose some things that we got back as kind of a privilege for getting our numbers down. So far, that hasn't been the case, though. We've seen that schools closing has been largely up to localities if they hit certain numbers or if they fall into a microcluster zone. And that's, I think, been a little bit confusing for some people who wonder if we see a lower spread in schools, a lower spike in schools, why aren't we doing something about places like restaurants or gyms?
Right, exactly. We saw schools in New York City close this week, at least through Thanksgiving. We don't know when they're going to reopen. And I remember the governor saying either last week or 2 weeks ago that, or it was over the weekend,
all runs
last
together.
Weekend. Yeah, exactly. He was saying on a conference call with us that he was suggesting that New York City should take the positivity rate of the schools themselves versus the positivity rate of the actual borough. And if the school was below 3%, then you could keep the schools open and then they would reassess everything. So this week we had kind of a strange interaction between the mayor and the governor. I don't know if you saw Jimmy's story in the Wall Street Journal about the phone call day. I think it, what was it, Tuesday? Or Monday, you're right, the days all run together, that the schools were closed.
Right.
You had a very testy exchange in the Red Room with Jimmy, and you were there.
Yeah, I think it was interesting. One, it was interesting because we saw the governor and the mayor say the same thing in largely different timelines, but that's kind of new for them. And two, it seemed to be that he really wanted to stick with saying the mayor could do what he wanted with schools. And when people were asking about the discrepancies in their numbers or even in the timeline that we saw, he became very upset and very defensive of the plan that he had already put in place and seemed set to follow.
I think we're at a time right now where we have gone past the first wave, and I disagree with his analysis that a second wave is when the virus mutates. I think that it's very clear that we are on some sort of wave. I mean, even the shape of a wave, we're there. It's just, it's so scary as to what's happening. And I think what's happening right now is the governor is taking some criticism for things that he may have done in the past to prevent the first wave. He's not doing them right now, like closing things down earlier, stuff like that. And he said that in the past. We have about a minute left. I want to pivot to the elections really quick. So Senate Dems picked up a few more seats this week that they had won through absentee ballots. We are talking on Friday, and as of right now, they have 40 seats they have won. They've declared victory. What's your predictions? Do you think we get to 41, 42?
I'm going to call 41, but there's no way of knowing that. Just like we all tried to make some analysis after Election Day, we see these ballots come in and they switch. And if you look at it as a glass half full, it makes it a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly. Love to see the results as they continue to come in. The absentee ballot process is so slow in New York. And I know that's something that lawmakers are looking at maybe for next year's session. Hopefully we don't have a pandemic to cause so many absentees, but we'll see. We'll leave it there. Anna Grunewald from Politico, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Democrats announced a few more wins in the state Senate this week after more absentee ballots were counted across the state. They'll hold a majority again next year in the Senate, handing Democrats total control over the state legislature for another two-year term. And that could have big implications for a lot of different issues, like marijuana legalization and affordable housing. But next year, those conversations will all exist in the context of the coronavirus and the state's massive budget deficit. I spoke with Senate Deputy Majority Leader Mike Gianaris about their plans for next year with Democrats again in the majority. Senator Gianaris, thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be with you, Dan.
So Democrats will keep the majority in the state Senate going into next year. When you first won the majority in 2018, you really hit the ground running when you came into office in 2019, passing some really controversial bills like the Child Victims Act and the RHA. When you're going into next year having that majority again, do you have any top priorities that you're looking at? What's on your list?
Well, first of all, we're really proud of the work we did over our first term in office. It was historic. It was the most productive session that New York has ever seen. We're really proud of our efforts and what we did. Now, what does that mean going forward? So much has is colored now by the pandemic and coronavirus and our response to it. So I do expect that 2021 will be largely consumed by budget questions. How do we fill the large budget gap that we have? Where do we find revenues to fill that hole? And how do we avoid deep cuts that will impact people's lives and do much more damage to the state than is already being done? So I do expect a large part of the conversation to be around those issues. That's not to say we don't have other things of great import to do. We're going to continue to focus on standing up for working people, leveling the playing field. And some of these things are all interrelated. The budget decisions we make have an impact on people's lives and have an impact on income inequality and wealth inequality in our state. So it's going to be a very busy year, without a doubt, and we have our work cut out for us.
You know, when you're talking about the deficit, how do you think the state should close the deficit? We obviously have a lot of different ideas, like the governor's waiting for the federal government to come up with the money and send it to New York. Others want higher taxes on the ultra rich. Others want things like the stock transfer tax. A lot of different ideas. Where do you land on that?
Well, look, no one answer is going to solve all the problems because the budget problems are so vast due to the economic shutdowns we've experienced. Yes, it would be great if the federal government comes through, and there's a much greater likelihood of that now that Joe Biden's going to be our president. Of course, the Republican Senate in Washington is unlikely to be helpful. So we'll see where that comes down, but we have to be prepared to move forward. It's my opinion that we at all, under any circumstances, need to avoid deep cuts to important services. Doing that causes much more damage than raising revenue from those who can afford it. Every major economic study has shown that. And so I fall on the side of let's make sure that the wealthy who have, by the way, done very, very well during the pandemic while others are suffering, let's ask them to chip in even more than they already do to get us through this difficult time. You're seeing the wealthiest among us increase their wealth exponentially just over the last 6 to 9 months during the awful time that we've had, while other people are out of work, can't pay their rent, don't have jobs. And so it seems to me a very clear-cut question is let's ask those who have to give. They should be expected to do more because they have more.
Is there any worry in the idea of a veto from the governor? I know that he has been against higher taxes on the ultra wealthy. He's come around a little bit in recent months, but is there any worry of Democrats in the Assembly and Senate coming together on that idea and then having it get pitched to the ditch, I guess, by the governor?
Well, depending on how these absentee counts come out, will affect everyone's bargaining power over that question and others. The Assembly already has a supermajority. It's been secured. The Senate, we are still fighting to get it. As you pointed out, the governor's already softened. I do not think it's acceptable for either house in the legislature to look at deep school aid cuts, deep health care cuts, things that really dictate whether people can choose to live in New York or not. We hear a lot about this fiction that if we raise taxes too much on the wealthy, they might flee. Well, I can promise you, if we cut to the bone, to the point where our schools are not as good as they can be, or our hospitals are not as good as they can be, then people really, and it won't just be a couple of billionaires, it'll be people by the thousands. So let's make sure we get this right, maintain the services people expect us to provide. And the best way to do that is to ask those who have to give.
You know, another revenue raiser that people are talking about for next year is possibly legalizing marijuana finally. We've been talking about it for the last several years. It seemed to gain some momentum since the Democrats took the majority in the Senate. Do you think this deficit is the final impetus to get across the finish line, especially after New Jersey voters voted to legalize it down there in November?
Yeah, well, I think it's something we should have already gotten done. And it seems that there's general agreement that we want to get it done. I think the stumbling block has been where does the revenue generated go in terms of, is it just dumped into the general fund for the governor to do with as he pleases as part of the budget process, or do we dedicate it to certain communities that have suffered unduly due to the criminalization of marijuana all these years? That's what we have to figure out. I think we need to figure it out. I will just give a word of caution to everyone saying that because we need the revenue from legalization won't be realized right away. You have to set up a whole industry and a whole regulatory structure. So I don't know that it'll help us in the next several months get through the immediate budget gap, but certainly revenue going forward will continue to be necessary.
So the economic impact of the coronavirus obviously extends beyond the state government. It extends down to renters and tenants, which are having a really hard time right now during the pandemic. And the moratorium on evictions at the federal and state level both expire at the start of next year. I know that you've been a proponent of the cancel rent movement, which would allow rent payments to be waived for certain low-income tenants, but that idea doesn't seem to have much favorability from the governor, I guess. So if not canceling rent, how do you think the state could be helping these tenants at this really tough time?
Well, look, here's the problem. There is a massive amount of rent that is due, and someone's got to pay for it one way or the other. Ideally, the federal government would show up and write everyone a check and pay the rent for them, and that would make everybody whole, and small homeowners wouldn't suffer either, and life would go on. I don't know the likelihood of that. Again, we have a little bit more hope because of the new president coming in, but I don't know how much resistance the U.S. Senate Republicans are going to provide for that. My view was, let's start at the bottom of the economic ladder and say, those who are most in need, let's help them first. Let's say if you owe rent, we've denied you your job essentially by order of the government, by shutting down the economy, then we should also nullify your biggest financial obligations in the short term. Now, I understand that has an impact for small landowners, small homeowners, and that's why I also think that we should have mortgage forgiveness and some support so that they don't suffer either. But what we do know is those higher up the economic ladder, whether it's the banks providing the mortgages or the very big real estate holding companies that can absorb these costs, have the ability to pay. It's really just another way of having the conversation we just had. Those that are doing well should be asked to do more rather than creating an eviction crisis or a homelessness crisis that would follow that. There's already some suffering going on, and if even the more inadequate moratorium expires without a solution, it's going to be a crisis.
Before I let you go, I just want to unpack the election results really quickly with you. State Democratic Chair Jay Jacobs had said in a recent interview that phrases like defund the police may have hurt Democrats at the poll this year. Obviously, you're not losing certain seats in the legislature right now. I'm wondering how you respond to that. Do you think the police reforms and the defund the police movement hurt Democrats at the poll? And what does that mean for the party in New York going forward?
Well, people are very quick to make judgments on partial results to further their ideological goals. What we shouldn't do as Democrats is draw a conclusion that the attacks the Republicans are hitting us with are the cause of everything that's wrong, therefore let's not advance our agenda. We need to come together as a conference. We have a diverse conference with a lot of different views. It's going to get more diverse as we win more states upstate in this cycle. And we come to consensus and we move forward. But I certainly am not one to allow Republicans to dictate our direction. That's part of the problem I believe the Democratic Party has had. We're way too reactive to the criticisms of those who oppose us. We should figure out what we think is the best way forward as our own in our own house, and then move that way. But to say that because we were attacked by something, and then to unfairly say we lost because of it, even when we won, just seems backwards to me.
All right, Senate Deputy Majority Leader Mike Gianaris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dan.
More now on the state's $14 billion budget gap. We just heard Senator Gianaris talk about why he supports raising taxes on the ultra wealthy to tackle the deficit. But another idea is called the stock transfer tax. We've talked about it on the show before. It would basically place a teeny tiny tax on stock transactions, which would add up to a lot of money. And that money could be used to fund things that are facing cuts right now, like education. That's part of why my next guest supports the idea. Fred Kowal is the president of United University Professions, the union that represents SUNY workers. Fred Kowal from UUP, thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here, Dan. Thank you.
Absolutely, anytime. So UUP is putting its weight behind something called the stock transfer tax, which would basically place a small tax on stock transactions in New York. It's one of several ideas, obviously, for raising revenue for the state. Tell me why UUP is putting its weight behind this one instead of raising taxes on the wealthy or even making some cuts to the budget in certain places.
Well, first and foremost, yeah, we do support raising the tax on millionaires and billionaires. However, we think that the stock transfer tax, for two reasons, makes the most sense. First, it can be put in place quickly. It can generate revenue because the fact is the state already collects the tax, but it rebates it back to those making stock transfers. The second is that it would generate money immediately, which we believe is vitally important given what New York State is facing, not just right now, but because of years, especially in the case of SUNY, for years of flat budgets and very little growth in the SUNY budget, which now becomes more and more important given the fact that our economy is going to have to recover from this depression. And so we're going to need the investment in higher education, probably more now than ever before.
So before we get to SUNY and CUNY, what do you say to the critics of the stock transfer tax who have said that maybe it will cause people to deal their stock transactions somewhere else other than the stock market in New York, and then we won't get that money at all? What do you say to those people?
A couple points. One is that this is a tax that is in place in London, which is another financial capital, and it remains one of the great financial capitals of the world. Hong Kong, the European Union is going to put it in place across the entire community. And also in Switzerland, they have this tax. So it is fairly common. The second is, I think what's important to realize is these transactions, for the most part, are electronic, occurring all over the country. And so therefore, it is a way for New York to make some money back for all of the economic activity that is happening from a distance, but in fact is focused on the New York Stock Exchange. This is our opportunity to tap into the biggest industry in New York State, much like Texas taxes natural gas wells and creates for itself the largest endowment for public higher education in the country. We see this as a way of doing something very similar in New York State.
So like you said, the state would realize revenue immediately from the stock transfer tax, which is really important because of the budget deficit the state is facing right now. It's $14 billion heading into next year. You represent workers at SUNY, and I'm wondering what we know right now about state spending on SUNY. Are we looking at cuts right now? Have there been cuts? What are the finances looking like?
Well, you know, so far, what has occurred is that the state has withheld funding to SUNY as it has withheld funding to local governments and also, you know, K-12 schools across the board. There has been a withholding of money that was budgeted. At the same time, there is discussion about what could be coming in the next fiscal year in terms of real cuts. Right now, the biggest impact that has occurred is twofold. One is that there has been some reduction, although much smaller than what we have seen occur, for instance, at CUNY, some reduction in the lines of part-time employees, both adjuncts and part-time professional staff. The other thing that has occurred, of course, that is of great concern to us, is that there has not been the funding going forward to compensate people, especially who have worked in our SUNY hospitals, who were dealing with COVID in March, putting their lives on the line, and yet they're among very few hospitals in New York State that have not received hazardous duty pay. That needs to happen. And you know, as a matter of fact, we have our members working in residence halls, in dormitories, where they are also dealing with COVID patients at places like Cortland and previously at Oneonta. These are also frontline workers. And I think the state owes it to them to compensate them for the fact that they're taking on this hazardous duty to keep us all safe during this tough time.
All right, Fred Kowal from United University Professions, thanks so much for being here as always.
Thanks, Dan.
For now, the future of SUNY and the state's budget deficit will depend on what lawmakers do going forward at both the state and federal level. And speaking of federal lawmakers, have you ever wondered how likely your member of Congress is to work across the aisle? The Common Ground Committee had the same question, so they scored every member of Congress on how likely they were to work out differences on important issues. Eric Olson is a co-founder of the Common Ground Committee. He says voters have an appetite for lawmakers who want to work across the aisle. Take a look. Eric, thanks so much for being here.
Happy to be here, Dan.
So you measure politicians based on how likely they are to work across the aisle. That's how you measure federal lawmakers and state lawmakers here in New York. But I feel like we're at a point in this country where people are more divided than ever. And I think you see that in the recent elections and certainly the campaigns leading up to it. Based on what we know now from the election results, do you think that voters have an appetite for selecting candidates that are willing to work across the aisle?
Absolutely. And I think it's evident in the results of the election. The fact that Donald Trump lost the election, or appears to have lost the election, and yet the Republican Party as a whole did as well as it did, in my interpretation, that's evidence that voters do not like the kind of messaging that the president has engaged in, where he's using anger and vitriol against his opponents and not having reasoned conversations. I definitely think that the majority of Americans are more interested in the solutions to problems than they are in the arguments over them.
So let's look at New York. We have 27 members of Congress here in New York. I'm wondering, our congressional delegation as a whole, and I'll get to the specifics in a moment, but do we see our representatives in Congress from New York typically working in a bipartisan way down in Washington, or do they typically vote along partisan lines?
Well, obviously it varies a great deal within the state and within districts within the state. But I would say as a representative group, there is a fair amount of working across the aisle taking place by New York legislators.
So let's look at the specific lawmakers in New York State right now, members of Congress. Who is most likely to work across the aisle and who is least likely to work across the aisle in terms of New York State?
Yeah, so in the category of most likely, and now you're going to, put shame in my last comment, Anthony Brindisi was had the highest score, one of the highest scores in all of Congress, with a score of 100. And unfortunately, he lost his election. But we see Peter King, who also scored very well, Tom Reed, who scored very well. And it's important to remember that this is not a comment about whether a representative is middle of the road or does not have strong political biases one way or another. It's really a measure of, even with those, are they willing to talk with those on the other side to try and find solutions and to reach out? And I think that's something that as more people are made aware of this, there'll be more support for representatives who engage in that kind of activity.
So we've seen President-elect Joe Biden possibly take some Republicans to come into his cabinet or certainly in senior levels of his administration. Do you think that is a sign towards maybe a new era of unity in the country, toward a political season, maybe in the next 2 years, 4 years, where we see more candidates that are looking more likely to work across the aisle?
I very much hope so. I would say It's encouraging. We'll wait to see how well the president-elect does at reaching out to those on the other side. We've had a lot of conversations with members of Congress, and I think that a significant issue here is that the leadership of Congress is not enthusiastic about letting people work with those on the other side, and I think the more people are aware of this, and the more people recognize the value of trying to find common ground, there'll be greater and greater support for this.
All right. Well, we will be watching as the new Congress is sworn in January down in Washington, D.C. Eric Olson from the Common Ground Committee, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We'll have a link to the full scorecard for every lawmaker in New York State on our website. That's at nynow.org. Head there every day for updates from the state capitol and around the state. And follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We're at nynow_PBS. But until then, thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.
And by the Dominic Ferrioli Foundation.